My name is Jim Miller, and I'm a very grateful recovering Al-Anon. And I appreciate this water today. I usually don't need it, but I've been bothered by some allergies, and I've taken an antihistamine. My mouth's a little dry, so I may actually need it today. I want to thank, this is a great opportunity to be here out at Mont Eagle. It's not a tremendously great opportunity to have to speak, but it's a great opportunity to be here. It's a great opportunity to see some old friends, George and Marge, M, known them for a long, long time. We stayed in their hotel up in Atlanta one time when I was trying to get Christy into the hospital, but we wound up spending the night at their hotel instead. Back in 1980. And Jim and Mickey have known them a long time. I've seen Juanita and Bob at Norman Park down at our state Al-Anon convention. I have a story that I need to tell you about Jim, though, because I was at the Alabama State Al-Anon convention, and Jim reminded me of this story about last time he saw Christy, how she kind of cried and said that when she grew up, she wanted to be just like him after him. I hope Christy doesn't get that wish. I mean, you know, I love her a lot, but that could do something to our marriage if she is just like Jim. We've gone through a lot, but I'm not sure it'd survive that. George, last night, I was up there and I was watching George ring the bell. And I was really kind of fascinated. That's wonderful, you know, because usually bells right now are electronic kinds of things. And George is up there pulling, and I said, George, that's wonderful. He says, yeah, he says, 15 minutes after this bell rings, something is supposed to happen. And Kevin reminded us of that today when he came up here. Well, I want y'all to know that after the meeting tonight at 10:30, I'm going to go ring that bell, grab Christy, and we're going back to our room. So if any of y'all have similar ideas, get ready to grab. Maybe it'll work for you too. I love laughter, you know, there are a lot of drunk stories. Not that many Al-Anon stories. Not very many funny Al-Anon stories, anyway. But there are a couple. One, you know, a couple that I like, and one is about how many Al-Anons it takes to change a light bulb. You know, you've heard these. You know, the how many this or how many that it takes to change a light bulb. You know how many Al-Anons it takes? None. The Al-Anon just attaches, moves back, and tells the light bulb to change itself. But I guess my all-time favorite Al-Anon story, because I identify with it so much, is that you can always tell when an Al-Anon is about to die, someone else's life flashes before their very eyes. I grow through pain. I grow through pain. And when I came into Al-Anon, my stepmother, who at this time had many, many years in Alcoholics Anonymous, gave me a little slip of paper that my father had carried around in his wallet. My father had 5 years in Alcoholics Anonymous before he died. And then it was a little quote from a book that a man named Paul had written to a group of people in Rome many, many years ago. And it said that from suffering comes endurance, from endurance comes character, and from character comes hope that will never leave us. And, you know, I just believe that's true in my life, that unfortunately or fortunately, or this is just the way it is, perhaps through acceptance, that it is from pain and suffering that I grow. When things are going pretty well in my life, I tend to want to just kind of drift along. And I can enjoy that, and I'm grateful for those times, and they're good times. But it's when there are times when I have to get down, when there's pain and suffering, that's what encourages me to grow. And in my story, I know that my pain might not have been as great as some others, or it might have been greater than others, but it was enough for me in order to get me to grow. And I see this throughout. So today I'm grateful that I married an alcoholic because of the fact that it caused me enough pain that I was willing to reach out for help to a group of people in Al-Anon and to a power greater than myself in order to ask for help. I remember when Christy went into treatment for the first time. We were in Dallas, Texas, and we had a daughter less than a year old, and I brought her around a year old and brought her to back to Georgia to live with my sister for a while. And I was in my stepmother's house, sitting in some rocking chairs on the second floor of this big Victorian home. And my sister and I were talking, and I was crying and telling her about going to Al-Anon and how I was getting some help. My sister's 5 years older than I am, and tears came to her eyes, and she said, "Jim, I've worried about you all your life because you've always been able to take care of everything." See, and I thought that's what I was supposed to do. I thought that I was supposed to take care of everything, you know. And up until that point, I'd done a pretty good job of it, at least externally, taking care of things. Valedictorian, cum laude, honor society in medical school, one of the finest residencies in the country. Things on the outside were successful, and I had taken care of things. But I know that on the inside, I was spiritually bankrupt as much as any alcoholic living in the gutter. I had no idea what life was about, no idea of what was reality in this world, because somehow I thought that reality were all those things that were going on around me. And you know, I knew something was missing. I remember having the conscious thought before I joined Al-Anon when I was doing my residency, I guess that's all there is to life. Yes, I'm going to be a doctor. I am a doctor. I'm going to help some people. That's nice. I guess I'll make a little money, live in a nice house, join the country club, play a little golf, have some dinner parties, enjoy some friends. And I guess that's just the way it is. You know, nothing wrong with that. Nothing bad about that. But it seems like something's missing. And you folks in AA and Al-Anon showed me what was missing, which is really a spiritual life and a God of my understanding. I'm so very grateful to you today. And as Christy reminds me, when we are invited to a beautiful weekend like this, or when I talk about the spiritual growth I had, and she said, "Yeah, Jim, it's just because I took, you know, one drink one time too often." Yeah, pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. I grew up in an alcoholic home. My father was kind of alcoholic, and I don't remember any real problems till maybe around the age of 11 or 12, but my father would come home, get drunk, and go to sleep. Not abusive, not a real problem. I don't remember a lot of arguing in the family between my... I remember arguments before my father's alcoholism got so bad. Finally, I guess he started going to sleep rather than arguing. But I grew up in, you know, in that home. And I don't want to downplay the effect that it had on me, because I know today that it did have an effect, but I also don't want to overemphasize that it was a terribly abusive home. It was just a home in which my father was emotionally absent. He wasn't there for me. And he was just not there. And I also don't believe in cause and effect. I just want to kind of describe the way that I was, because... when I look back, I don't like myself very, very much at this age, 12 or 13 years old. To let you know kind of how I was, I remember at one point we were going to get a new car. And this was the first year that that Ford was putting out the LTD, the Galaxy LTD. It was the top of the line. The Galaxy had been the top of the line before. They were putting out the Galaxy LTD. There was a big deal about it, lots of advertisements in the paper. It was quieter than a Rolls Royce. They'd done all these tests. And I was excited because we were getting an LTD. And my father drove home in a Galaxy. He didn't buy the top of the line. And I was pissed. Now, I didn't tell anybody I was angry, but I was hurt. I felt like somehow I deserved to drive around in the top of the line. Well, is there something about that? When my dad's alcoholism progressed, we got a divorce. We lived in one of the largest houses, you know, in this little town of 6,000 Manchester that I grew up in. And we had to move into another house about two blocks away, a fine, wonderful, beautiful little home, but it wasn't one of the largest houses. And I was embarrassed. I remember consciously thinking of when my friends would drop me off. Maybe I'd let them drop me off in front of our old house and I would walk the two blocks to the new house so they wouldn't know that we had had to have moved. Right. Now that says nothing about my father's alcoholism, just a lot about me. We'll make that clear, a lot about me. And I don't like that little kid very much today, but I love him. Because there's a lot of that that's still within me, and I have to watch it through this program and working my recovery program today to look back and to not be that way today. The promises have come true for me. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. Need to remember that. I grew up in that home, went away to stay in. My father went away to what was treatment at that point. He went away to live with John Mooney, a doctor in Statesboro, Georgia, for a while. And when he came back on the day I graduated from high school sober, and he didn't have another drink for the 5 years until he died. And beautiful AA years for him. After he'd been sober about 2 years, I was home from college during the summer. And I remember this night, it's one of the most vivid memories of my life. And it was a hot July night, and we were sitting outside of the little apartment that he lived in and sitting on the trunk of his car and looking out at the stars. And as I remember it, there have never been that many stars before that night that I'd ever seen on this hot July night. All the summer stars were out, and I was looking at it, and I remember it vividly. And my father asked me, he said, "Jim, do you remember a letter that you wrote to me while I was down at Dr. John's?" I said, "What? I believe I remember what letter you're talking about." And he said, "In it you wrote to me that you loved me because any son would love his father, but that you had lost your respect for me." And he said, "Jim, that letter's in my top drawer, and I'd like to be able to tear it up and throw it away. If you can tell me that you respect me today." And I said, "Dad, you know, I hope that, you know, the way that I've talked with you and the way that I've shown you, I hope that I have shown you that I do respect you." And he said, "You have, but, you know, I need to hear the words." And I told him, "Yeah, I love you, Dad, and I respect you. I see what you're doing. And I see how you weren't running your life, and I see how you're working with others, and I see that the love that you have in your life today, and yes, I respect you." And I don't remember my father using the word amends, and I certainly didn't know what the word meant at that point. But I believe that in some way there was some healing that occurred as if in a ninth step on that night. Because when I look back at it, that's a very important moment. And since that time, since my time in Al-Anon, that has taught me a very, very important lesson, something about respect and something about love. Because you see, today I respect, as best I can, every other human being, because we're just all fellow children of God. You're my brothers, you're my sisters. And you deserve, I believe you deserve my respect simply for your very existence. Now, I didn't admire my father's alcoholism. I didn't admire some of the things that occurred. I didn't admire some of his actions. And I might not admire some of your actions today, but I respect you. Because, see, I'd gotten admiration and respect all mixed up. Today, I believe that I should respect every other human being just because we're brothers and sisters, fellow children of God. And I know that when I can treat with respect, the dirtiest person who I see, person who has done things that I don't admire. But I believe that helps me in my spiritual program. Because that's the kind of God, that's the kind of love that my God has. And I have to look at that as perfect love. You know, God lets us do the things. My God lets me do the things, makes mistakes. Now, He can make me perfect. He can make me do the things that I'm supposed to do. You know, He can say, "You do this, Jim, you'll be okay. I'm going to make you do that." But no, He allows me to make mistakes. He allows me to do the wrong thing. He allows me to learn from that. And then I have to say that must be perfect love. And when I can let go of control and let go of guidance in other people's lives today, And I say, yeah, I'm more perfectly loving. I'm more perfectly loving. Still have a hard time doing that. You know, I want people to behave the way I want them to behave sometime today. Lots of times today. I try to let go of that. And being loving is, as I understand that my God loves me. Well, I mentioned that I was away at school. I was at Duke University, and there at Duke, met Christy. We were both there in school together, and we had a good time. We fell in love, partied hard, drank hard together some, but had lots of good times, studied hard, and things were good. Eventually decided I wanted to marry her. And I remember at our rehearsal dinner the night before we were married, I raised a glass of champagne and I toasted to the woman who taught me how to love. Yeah, I was 22, 23 years old. I knew nothing about love. And there certainly wasn't anything Christy could teach me about it. But I tell you what, I guess we had as much love between us as any 22-year-old people did, you know. But even to think that somehow I understood something about love today is just kind of ludicrous. It really is just funny. But it's okay. It's okay. Yeah, we were doing the best we could. Drinking wasn't a problem then. We were in love. We didn't love each other, but we were in love with each other. And now when I'm looking back at that, when you're in love, when I was in love with Christy, I don't know about you, when I'm in love with Christy, Christy was my God. She was supposed to do for me. She was supposed to make me happy. I was supposed to make her happy. You know, she was my God. I was in love with her. I was in love with some idea of who she is. Christy told me one time, she said, Jim, I'm really a shy person. I said, no, you're not. She said, yes, Jim, I know that I don't look like a shy person, but I really am quite shy inside. And I said, no, you're not. And she said, Jim, listen to me. I say I'm a shy person. I said, I wouldn't have married a shy person. Yeah, you can't be shy. I was in love with whoever it was that I thought Christy was supposed to be. You know, I had her up on a pedestal, and she better not climb off of it. You know, that's where I wanted her to be. And I believe that at that time, I was her God, and she was my God, because we were looking to each other for whatever it was that we needed, not to anyone else. Yeah. Not to anyone else. We had a perfect marriage, we thought. We had perfect friends. We were going to have a perfect life. Everything was just wonderful. I went ahead, went to medical school, went out to Dallas, Texas to do my residency. And everything was just perfect. And internship and residency is pretty hard. I was at the hospital 36 hours, home for 12, at the hospital for 20, at the hospital for 12 hours, home for 12, then back at the hospital for 36 hours, and went on that way pretty much most of the time for the full 3 years. Third year's a little break. But no problem. This wasn't going to cause problems in our marriage because, we had the perfect marriage. And what's about perfection? You don't have to work on perfection, right? Nothing's wrong. It's perfect. We'll just take a little year apart. Everything will be okay. And then we'll come back and be right where we were before. Everything's fine. And so as things began to crumble in my marriage, I did not recognize it. Or if I recognized it, it was just because of my schedule. I had no idea that anything was really wrong. Till one night I arrived home to a darkened apartment, our little girl asleep, no lights on. And Christy was lying in the bed crying. And I knew something awful had happened. I thought maybe her parents had died in a, airplane accident. I knew something awful had happened. She began to tell me the story of her drug addiction. And how she needed to have some help. And I had no idea. Absolutely no idea. And I got her up in my arms, and I said, everything's going to be okay. I'm grateful to somehow, I believe, that my dad and his program in Alcoholics Anonymous and my stepmother, Lillian, because by this time my father had died, and Lillian and her AA program, that somehow I had some idea that there was hope, that there was hope. Now, I kind of went looking for hope in all the wrong places. The next day I got up and I went down to the medical school Southwestern Medical School in Dallas, and I went to the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry and asked me for the best private psychiatrist in addictions in the city of Dallas, called up, made an appointment for Christy to see him, and I'd taken care of that problem and knew everything was going to be okay. You know, I'd done what I was supposed to do, had a problem, Christy told me about it, I went out, fixed it, set up the thing, and then everything was going to be okay. And, you know, we've been happy, and she's been sober ever since, you know, and it's, everything's just great. And we'll No, we were a long way, both of us were a long way from recovery at that point. But soon after that, Christy called Lillian, my stepmother, who's in AA, and just said, Lillian, I need help. And Lillian was on a plane out to Dallas within 24 hours. That's all she said, I need help. Now, later on, Lillian said that all the way out there, all the way to Dallas on the plane, she kept thinking, what has that boy done to her? Now, this is my other mother. We didn't even call her stepmother. We were so close. My other mother, but she was sure that I had done something to Christy. And she came out there and she told us we needed to go to AA and Al-Anon. Well, we did. And I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting out there, and I explained to him that Christy only had a drug problem, that she was a successful social drinker, that she drank and that was okay, and I drank and that was okay, and I didn't have any problem with her drinking at all. She just had this drug problem. Now, this is my own experience, strength, and hope. You know, that's the only thing that I can share. They told me to keep coming back. And I'm thank God they did. I really am glad that somebody didn't say, this isn't for you. We aren't here for you. We aren't here for you. Now, I didn't disrupt the meetings, and I didn't say that my wife wasn't an alcoholic, and I didn't disrupt the meetings, and I didn't talk about that all the time. And, you know, and I understand that that can affect the unity, but all I did was talk to people before and after the meetings, and at that point, you're a drinking one a problem. They said, you know, just give it some time. Just give it some time. We, and I'm real grateful for that today. I'm real grateful for that today, and that people didn't tell me that I didn't belong. I continued to go to Al-Anon for a little while. That was in April of 1979. In July of 1979, I got a week of vacation. We came back east. Now, we really came to the south, but you know, when you're in Texas, it's east. You know, it was kind of. Right. So we came back east, and came to visit some friends, and went around. I was looking at places where I might want to set up my practice, and we were in North Carolina. And we went to visit Christy's brother in Charlotte, and he wasn't there the first night we were there, and there's no one at home, but he told us to come in and make ourselves at home, and something strange happened. Christy was not acting like herself. She was strange, acting weird. And I began to think that maybe she had had a stroke. Or that she had acute Alzheimer's disease. And I couldn't figure it out. And I mean, I was really concerned. But we woke up the next morning, and everything seemed to be okay. She seemed to be herself. You know, I kind of tested the things out. I didn't say anything. You know, but everything seemed to be okay. Her brother came home that day. I didn't say anything to him about what had happened. But I was looking, you know, for any telltale signs, you know, of this stroke that might have occurred. And decided it was probably a TIA, transient ischemic attack, where it never doesn't really go all the way. It's just kind of strange. But and her brother came home, and that night we all had a couple of drinks before dinner, and Christy had more than a couple, and she got drunk, and I realized that's what was wrong last night. You see, I'm smart, you know, I could compare the two events. Learn from the experience. See, but I hadn't seen her drinking the night before. As far as I knew, she had never hidden her drinking from me. She had been hiding her drinking from me. It was the first time I'd recognized it. And drinking was a problem. Drugs, after that point, after that first time, drugs were never a problem, but drinking was a problem for a long time. Drinking was a problem for a long time. I continued to go to Al-Anon during that time, and a lot of times I went for all the wrong reasons, really. I just went because it was the right thing to do. I'd always done the right thing. I was a good supportive husband. All this is retrospect now. You know, I didn't know this at the time, but you know, I was a good supportive husband. No one was ever going to say that I hadn't supported her through all this. I was going to do what I was supposed to do. I think I was still kind of in denial about the full, about all of this. Christy never drank in front of me. She continued to drink and go to meetings. Real grateful for that. Real grateful. Gave me hope. As long as she went to meetings, it allowed me to continue with my hope. Glad she drank and went to meetings. December, but she never drank in front of me. She'd always hide it. December 26th of that year, I was telling Bob beforehand, if we celebrated birthdays, I'd probably celebrate December 26, 1979 as my birthday, because on that day I went to a meeting for me because I saw Christy with a drink in her hand. One drink. She wasn't drunk, any drunker than she always was, but I saw her with a drink in her hand, and it gave me such pain that I went to a meeting for me. And after that meeting, I picked out a woman, mainly women in those days, as Bob was talking about, but I picked out a woman who was a double winner. I think that at that point I really didn't quite trust you pure Al-Anons. I still was attracted to the AAs. I picked out this double winner. And I went to after the meeting, and I said, you know, she was there, her husband was in AA. We saw him at lots of meetings on the weekends, and I told her what a sorry, lying, conniving, manipulating bitch Christy was. That no one had ever had to live through this. She drank and went to meetings. She drank and lied. She hid her drinking. No one knew what was going on, and she had everyone fooled in AA. And Baba sat there and said, yes, I understand. I said, no, you don't understand. You aren't listening to me. No one has ever had to live through this. So she goes to meetings and everybody thinks she's sober and she's drinking. She is the lyingest, most deceitful person the world has ever known. She says, I understand, Jim. I said, no, you don't listen to me. You aren't listening. I said, your husband, I said, you know, he's sober. You know, you have that. You don't have to live like this. And she said, Jim, I said, you don't understand. She said, Jim, you see my husband on the weekends. When we go to meetings together, during the week he travels and drinks. And I knew she understood. I knew she understood. And you know, my memory of that is that all of that pain, all of that anger immediately went away because I knew someone really understood. Very powerful to me. You know, why is that a coincidence? You know, I've heard definition of coincidence. It's when God intervenes and wishes to remain anonymous. Yeah, I don't know why I picked her that night. I'm just glad I did. I'm just really glad I did because I knew she understood. Well, there's one problem about coming to Al-Anon before your wife has a drinking problem. Okay? That is, as I sat in those meetings, listened to all you Al-Anons laugh about the things that you used to do before you came to Al-Anon. I'd never done them, and I started doing them after I was in Al-Anon. Before I came to Al-Anon, I had never hunted for a bottle. Before I came to Al-Anon, I had never smelled Christie's breath to see if there was alcohol on it. Yeah, but I started doing it after. Now, I think that what recovery does for me is it makes me so I don't have to suffer quite as long. You know, I said I grow through pain, but I think what recovery does is I don't have to go through the pain as long. Okay, I learn more easily, but I still think I have to do some of those crazy things. You know, I was a champion bottle hunter, you know, and in our house he had to do it because, see, Christy picked up white chips all the time, and so what I'd have to do is I'd have to find a bottle and I'd put it up and I'd say, you've been drinking. I had to do this. Yeah, I had to do it. It was a compulsion. You know, I had to find the bottle, and then I'd say, you've been drinking. She'd say, Jim, that's an old bottle. That's from before my last white chip night before last. So then I would have to find a bottle that had some in it. Now, that was difficult. Put it back. And then come back the next morning, and then when it was empty, I knew that she had been drinking in the last 12 hours. And I had the proof, and I could confront her with the truth, and things would change. Because if I went to an open AA meeting with her, she'd pick up another white chip. Now, it didn't do anything for her drinking. But she'd pick up another white chip. Now, why? It's so incredible that there's something about that, that somehow I felt like if I knew the truth, that somehow I could do something about it. That somehow I had some power over whether or not she drank or not. Now, I had some, she allowed me to have some power about whether or not she picked up another white chip. But it did nothing for her drinking. But I continued to believe somehow that if I found the truth out and used this brain that God had given me, that there was some way that I could figure out something that would make her stop drinking. I still thought that I was powerful over her alcoholism. Now, if you had asked me at a meeting, I would have said, no, I believe otherwise. But my action showed that I still believed it. My action showed that I still believed that. I learned a lot of things in this time. We went to a couples meeting called the Family Afterward. Christy and I have, we learned from that. And when we got to Columbus, we've started one called the Family Afterward on Friday night. It's an open AA Al-Anon discussion meeting named after a chapter in the Big Book called the Family Afterward. And it's for couples living in sobriety. It's been a wonderful meeting for lots of people in the program. A lot of healing takes place. I'm not sure much healing happened while we were, you know, we were still in the midst of active alcoholism, but we went to this meeting regularly in Dallas, and I learned a lot from that meeting. But one night we were talking about humor. I talked about how I like to laugh, and talked you know about humor a little bit earlier, and we were talking about humor in the program, and you know how strange it is that you know we sit up here and people talk about how bad it was, and this happened and that happened. We all laugh, and then they get to the end of the sermon, and they talk about how good it is today, and we all cry. We were talking about the humor in the program, and I had really been particularly eloquent at the meeting that night. Because I had discussed how the difference between comedy and tragedy in the ancient Greek playwrights with some particular emphasis on Euripides. And feeling really good about the, you know, I kind of raised the quality of the discussion somewhat. And a woman came to me afterward and she said, Jim, Al-Anon lady, she said, Jim, we're here to share our own experience, strength, and hope. Not to show you how smart we are and what kind of education we have. And if you can't share your own experience, strength, and hope, shut up. Now, I don't know if that's exactly what she said, but I can tell you that's exactly what I heard. And I'm real grateful for that lesson. I heard what she said. Now, I still have resentment about it. But she's right. And I try to remember that, you know, as I share in my home group, as I share from up here, to try to share my own experience, strength, and hope. And it's my prayer always, one of the prayers, and I went to the chapel over here before I came in, this one of my prayers is, God, please help me share my own experience, strength, and hope. Because that's all I have. That's all I have to share with you. So I was learning. I was getting a little bit better. I had a sponsor who I'll talk about a little bit later on, Sally M. I never used my sponsor as well as I should, but I had one. I guess that's better than not having one. And I think sometimes we in Al-Anon don't use sponsors as well as we should, particularly us men in Al-Anon. I don't know. At least men in my home group seem to have a hard time with getting and using sponsors. But I had a sponsor, talked with her, and I was getting a little better. Moved to Columbus, Georgia, set up my practice of internal medicine, and immediately started going to Al-Anon again. Got regularly involved, and soon after that, Christy got sober. And things went well. It was a beautiful time. We had two more daughters, had a total of three daughters, a beautiful life. My practice was going well. Loved Al-Anon. Christy loved AA. Had lots of friends in the program. We'd moved to Columbus, joined the program, so we didn't have a lot of old friends to worry about. Almost all of our friends were in the program and understood us. And it was really just a beautiful, beautiful time. Lillian, my stepmother, knew everybody in AA in the state of Georgia, and I think most of the people in the Southeast, and she drug us around and introduced us to every one of them. And it was wonderful. And we had a great life, a beautiful life. And things were good. Things were good. But a few years later on, after about 3 years of this, 3 or 4 years of this sobriety, I began to get sick. Because I began to suspect that Christy was drinking. And the reason I say that I got sick, not not that I suspected she was drinking, but I didn't say anything to anyone. I didn't tell my sponsor, because what if I were wrong? I didn't talk about it in my home group, because I wouldn't want to accuse her of something. Now, you know, that's, you know, I said I believe this was a disease. But that's the way I thought in my mind. I couldn't accuse her of doing something. It doesn't look like I'm acting like this is a disease. And I got sicker and sicker, more worried, more worried, more fearful, more fearful. And finally, one day, I after several months of this, I sat Christy down. And I give thanks to Al-Anon for the way that I handled this, but I sat Christy down and I told her my fears, I told her my worries. And I said, Christy, I've just gotten real sick, and I'm sure because I've been concerned that you're drinking. And I'm sure that this has affected the way that I have treated you and that I've acted, and if I've been acting strange, I need to let you know why it is. I didn't ask her if she'd been drinking. I didn't accuse her of drinking, but I just talked about me and my feelings. And I said, I'm going to have to get some help with this, and I'm going to need to talk with my sponsor. I'm going to need to talk about it in my home group, and I'm going to need to do these things for me because it's really affected me. And I guess we talked for an hour, 2 hours about this, about me, about me. I'm real grateful that Christy talked to me about me. And the end of that conversation, I never asked her once if she were drinking. And but I felt like she was, and I went out and I talked about it. And I began to get a little better, and it was pretty soon after that that Christy got honest that she was drinking. And for the next year and a half or so, we had a lot more sober days than we did drinking days, not more dry days than we did drinking days, but I tell you, the drinking days in some ways were better than the drier ones. I learned what a dry drunk was. And I'm real grateful for that relapse. And when we sit in my home group and some people say, well, you know, I've been in the program for 5 or 6, 7 years and the program works for me, but I don't know what would happen if my spouse started drinking again. I don't know what I would do. And I say, well, I'm one of the lucky ones. I know Al-Anon works for me whether my spouse is drinking or not. I know it works for me. I'm one of the lucky ones. I don't have to wonder whether or not it will or not. And during that period of time, I learned some very valuable lessons. Because you see, during those first few years of sobriety, Christy and I did most everything together in the program. And during this period of time, Christy was not much fun to be with. And my Al-Anon program said, if Christy is either depressed or in this dry drunk or drinking, my program said, Jim, you're responsible for your own happiness. And I learned to be responsible for my own happiness. I didn't spend a lot of time with Christy because she wasn't a lot of fun to be around. And I was given the gift that found us given so often when we need it. You know, God puts a guy for me to sponsor in my life. And the gift of that friendship, of Sam's friendship, I'll be eternally grateful for. We spent a lot of time together. Learned so much. A lot of things that I'd never learned growing up about friendship. Because he gave me so much more than I did him, even though I was his sponsor. I remember as I was driving, and he had his own business, and he could pretty much leave at any time. And I was driving around, and we'd have lunch most every day, and we'd meet for coffee afterward. I mean, we'd talk program, and, you know, it was just great. Christy and I were going to marriage counseling every week pretty soon after this, every week. After that, we'd play tennis every week so that I could kind of decompress after this marriage counseling session. But, you know, we spent a lot of good time together. And I remember the thought came to my mind one time, says, I'm about to worry this guy to death. I'm calling him all the time, having lunch, doing this. I said, you know, I bet this guy is so sorry he asked me to be his sponsor. I'm bugging him to death. And a God of my understanding said, you know, Jim has gave me this thought, says, has Sam ever said that you're bugging him to death? No. That was inside. That was my own sense, I believe, today, what I call for, it's a buzzword, and I hate to use it, but I know it's, I don't have a better word for it. It's my own sense of shame of somehow I wasn't good enough. This guy couldn't really enjoy being in my company. He couldn't really want me to be his sponsor. He couldn't want to eat lunch with me. He couldn't want to have coffee with me. I'm not quite good enough. I'm not quite good enough. But luckily, I believe a God of my understanding said, Jim, you're telling yourself a lie. You know, and I checked out with Sam. I said, Sam, this is the way I feel. He said, no, Jim, says the reason you always, I don't ever call you is, you know, my schedule's free. You know, yeah, I wait for you to call me because that's the way we've worked things out. That's okay. So grateful. See, because I could have not called him. I could have believed that lie, not called and said, well, I'll wait and see if he calls me. And what the message for him would have been, Jim must be mad at me. He hadn't called me in a couple of days for lunch. I'd believed the lie. Believing a lie. The big book talks about believing a lie for the alcoholic, you know, that they can drink safely again. You know, and sometimes that lie to me is, Jim, I'm not quite good enough. There's something wrong with me. And there are times when I believe that lie. And I believe that a large part of my recovery over the past few years has been digging deep down inside so that I don't believe that lie, that somehow I believe that I am okay. I talked about how people send sponsors, send somebody for me to sponsor when I need to learn something. You know, we doctors learn from our patients. Okay? We learn from our patients, period. We spend a couple of years in medical school learning from books, but then the way that we really learn to become doctors is our patients teach us. We go out and we do it and we see what works and we see what doesn't work, you know. You know, we do that and we do it with a lot of help from people helping to show us how, but we learn from our patients. You know, we don't learn it all and then go out and be medicine. We call it the practice of medicine because we're continually having to change and to practice and to try this and do that. And I learn from my patients. And I know that the more I can open up to my patients today, I learn from them. I learn from them even today. This last week, I was talking to a patient and in an appropriate situation, I was talking something about love and talking about loving the part of me that I even want to get rid of, even loving my character defects. You know, yeah, I want to get rid of my character defects, but they are a part of me and I need to love them. And she said, charity. Charity. You know, in another big book, there's where it's, you know, faith, hope, and charity. The greatest of these is charity. You know, and charity is another word for love. But she said, charity, that's what it is here. And I love myself with charity. I like that word. Even the bad part of me, even those character defects, even as I want to get rid of them, I can be charitable toward myself. I have to tell y'all I'm a little nervous right now because I kind of in the past couple of weeks, I've been feeling like I've been rocketed into that fourth dimension of existence. You know, and it's okay to kind of do that on my own, but sometimes as I sit up here and I want to explain these things that are happening to me today, I kind of feel like it's unfair of y'all to kind of ask you to follow me into this fourth dimension, you know. Yeah. And if some of what I begin to say now doesn't make as much sense, you know, just bear with me. Bear with me. Because it's some stuff that I'm still trying to figure out and still trying to learn from. And one thing that I try to do when I share my own experience, hope, is not just to talk about what went on last year or 10 years ago, but kind of what's been going on now. Well, I learned, the patient this week taught me charity. Yeah, I like that. That comes a little bit closer to understanding what I mean when I say I need to love all of me, even the character defects, just as my God loves all of me, just the way I am. And when I can do that to myself, then I can love other people just the way they are, unconditionally. Not necessarily liking their character defects, not because they're behaving the way that I want them to, not because they're doing what I want them to do, but can love them just the way they are. Today I understand there's a little bit of difference between spiritual love and emotional love. Spiritual love to me is, I love you just the way you are, and it's a gift that I give to someone. Emotional love is I want something back. Now, I need both. You know, if I were a pure, because I'm not a purely spiritual creature. I have an emotional part of me, a mental part of me, and a physical part of me. And so, yeah, I need all of those needs taken care of, mental, emotional, and physical too. But the most important part of me, I believe, is the spiritual part of me. And the more that I can emphasize that spiritual part of me, and that spiritual love is I love you just the way you are without any expectation in return. Okay. Now, I need Christy for that emotional part of me. Yeah, that's real. That's a real part of me. But as long as I can remember that I believe that the highest form of love is that spiritual part of love, and I can love people in that way, then I can let go and let God and let His will be done and not my will be done. Christy eventually got sober again. I took her down to a place called Willing Way that Dr. John Mooney started. And that's where my father sobered up in Dr. John Mooney's home, and I eventually took her down there. She had no hope. I told her I was going to take her down there. She'd been in some other place for treatment and inpatient and outpatient for a year, and I said, "Well, I'm taking you down to Willing Way." And she said, "Jim, take me anywhere you want to. It doesn't matter. I don't care. There's no hope. I mean, I'll go anywhere you want me to. If you want me to come home, I'll go home. If you want me to go, doesn't matter. I'll go wherever you take me." And I took her there. And on the way, I talked with Al Mooney, Dr. John's son. He's a physician. He's a member of our Al-Anon family groups, and I use his name with his permission. And he told me the story of how everybody in his family was addicted, and he was concerned particularly about his little sister, and how she might die of her addiction, and there's nothing that he could do about it, and the pain that caused him. And on the way home, I was with a good friend of mine who's a recovering alcoholic who'd come driven down there with me. And I remember on the way home crying most of the way because I truly believed and understood the first step for the first time, which is that Christy could die of her alcoholism and there was absolutely nothing I could do about it. Now, I could take her to the hospital, but she could kill herself in the hospital and tried to. And she couldn't stay in the hospital forever. And when she got out, something could happen. And you see, I understood that you might die of your alcoholism, but I had never really accepted the fact that Christy might die of her alcoholism and there was nothing I could do about it. I knew other people did. And you know, that was a pretty powerful, that's a lot of pain. But from that pain, I believe, of taking that first step in a new way that I'd never really taken it, then I could move on to that second step where I could really come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity and understand even more so than I had before that my well-being, that my happiness depended on my relationship with my higher power. That Christy's alcoholism was a, and her recovery from it was between her and her higher power. And other people could influence it. It was between them. And that my recovery and my happiness was between myself and my higher power. And then I could really, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. Because what I could do is try to get self out of the way and let go and let God's will be done. And I'd had a hard time even taking it that third step the first time because I was afraid God would want me to go to Africa and be a medical missionary. And I told my sponsor that. I said, "I don't want to go to Africa and be a medical missionary. I want to live in a nice house, drive a nice car, have my kids go to good school." And she said, "Jim, if God wants you to go to Africa and be a medical missionary, that's because He knows that's where you will be the happiest. You might not think that's where you'll be the happiest, but that's where He will know that you will be the happiest." And I believe that today. Whenever I know that I get myself out of the way and let God's will take over, I know that things work out for the best. Christy got sober, came home. It's been a wonderful life these next few years. Things are real smooth in a lot of ways. Life's good. Sometimes I feel like I'm the most, God's given me the greatest gifts of any human being on earth. I'm real grateful for that today. Think of that guy, that young boy who didn't want that Galaxy LTD, he thought he deserved the LTD, or he wanted the LTD. Yeah. The last thing I would pray today is, "God, please give me what I deserve." The last prayer I would pray today. So things were too good, and I decided to let some other alcoholics in my life keep things kind of stirred up. We've had several surrogate children in our family, a surrogate daughter named Courtney, some surrogate sons, John and Bobby and Chris, and they've been a real joy. They've caused some pain, they've caused some suffering, but it's from them that I've learned so much, and I need to spend a little bit of time talking about that now, because I think that's really more about what's been going on now. And I said that I wanted to talk about kind of what's going on now. All of these have been real important, but there's one young man named John who's just been probably the closest thing that I'll ever have to a son. He's sober 3 years now in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's been in our lives for about 4 years. He came in through the office. Christy met him first, and Christy came in and he said, "Jim, you're really going to like this guy." And she was right. He was 16 years old, a long way from getting sober. And we spent a lot of time together. I gave him a job. He lived in our house for a while. Has a family. Mother's in Al-Anon. His father's in AA now. But found that he felt more comfortable at our home during a lot of his time, and spent a lot of time, ate most of his meals with us, even lived with us for a period of time, a week here, a week there. And I gave him a job. He worked for me, and he traveled with the family. We take him to conventions and things. I had a real hard time with some of that, because I wanted to reach out and to love him, and yet there was a part of me that didn't want to take the risk. It was real hard. I had to talk a lot to my sponsor. I had to talk to some other people in the program who I knew cared about me, in order to give me permission to do this. Because it seems strange to me. Because you see, I remember being so numb to feelings that when I was in college, I wondered if I remember when the thought occurred to me as I was walking across campus that if one of my parents were to die, would I care enough in order to cry at their funeral? Now, and Dad, this was after Dad's drinking was gone, and you know my mother wasn't a real problem, but I just didn't know when I cared about anyone enough to cry at their funeral. And so to kind of reach out to someone outside of the family in love was real difficult. And I'm so glad that I did. There's been a lot of pain in that, because he didn't get sober immediately, and he certainly hadn't, even in sobriety, he has not acted like I want him to act. But I've learned from that. You know, there are times when I've been felt real selfish in that love about what I wanted him to give me back. And it's in doing that, but I've learned that, yeah, that's not the kind of love that I want to have for him. I want that spiritual love that worry about what I give. There are times when I felt like Mary Poppins. Yeah, you remember the film Mary Poppins? You know, she goes into this family and it's in an uproar and the kids are there and the kids are just monsters. The parents don't care about them. And she puts the whole family back together. And then at the end, she's in her umbrella and she's riding off. You know, and she's looking back, kind of wistful. You know, that's what is it? Sometime I thought, well, you know, I put this guy's life back together, and all of a sudden he's going to dump me. You know, he wasn't acting like I wanted him to. He wasn't being grateful like I wanted him to. He didn't appreciate me. Felt like Mary Poppins at the end, and I thought, yeah, that's okay. That's okay. Mary Poppins was on her way to another family. Yeah. The big book says, but our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. A few weeks ago with this young man, there were a group of us who were meeting together, met together on this Wednesday night. We were just having a discussion. It was just at a friend's house. And I was describing some problems that I was having. He looked at me and he said, "Jim," he says, "it seems to me that," he was in the midst of some problems. He said, "Jim, it seems like to me that you have a problem right now of really realizing, of trying to fit yourselves to be a maximum service to God." He said, "I wish I had that problem right now." He said, "I'm just trying to get all this chaos in my life put together. And here you are, what you're worried about is how you can be of maximum service." What a gift. What a gift. You know what he gave me? When I can let go and reach back. I not to worry about what he, you know, can give to me, but what I can give. And I've been able to take these lessons out, I believe, a little bit better into other people. I was talking about that Thursday night when we were up here and at a beautiful meeting that we had. And I was talking about a guy named Charles. Charles died drunk in jail. He's in his early 30s. He had been to multiple treatment programs. He'd come from a fairly wealthy family, but they had discarded him. He's living in I called it a row house, but it's a shotgun house. It's a shotgun house, what he's living in. The family bought him a shotgun house so he'd have a roof over his head. It had no furniture in it, and he was drinking Sterno. And Charles had called me about 2 o'clock in the morning, and he called Christy at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and Charles would just be drunk, and he'd want to know what was wrong. And one night, as I was leaving work, he was out sitting outside, and he said, "Well, I'll do anything you want me to. I just want to get sober." And I said, "Well, I don't know what you're going to do tomorrow, but tonight you're coming home with me." He was filthy. He says, "No, I can't do that. I can't go to your house. Look at me." I said, "No, you've got to go. Got to go." He said, "No, I can't go to your house." I said, "Charles, you just told me you'd do anything." But I took him home, you know, gave him a shower, gave him some sweat clothes to put on. He spent the night in our guest bedroom. Little girls talked to him. And I told some friends of mine about that in Al-Anon and some friends that I work with, you know, and they said, "Jim, you're the biggest fixer the world's ever known. You can't get Charles sober." Yeah. I had no idea that was going to get Charles sober. I just wanted to love him. Just wanted to love him. And he always remembered that. He always remembered that. Probably one of the most important events of his life was that night he spent at our house, surrounded by love. Now, yeah, I knew. I mean, I believe in miracles. I wasn't going to say that he wasn't going to get sober, but I didn't bring him home. He watched me in the mornings. As he came in the morning, I was on my knees saying my morning prayers. And as Charles left me that morning, he said, "People actually do that, don't they? You were saying your prayers." I said, "Yeah." He said, "You know, when people would talk about that at meetings or when I've been in treatment talking about prayer," he says, "I just thought that was just a lot of talk. I didn't know when people actually did it." You know, it's our example that we set that carries the message. It's the example that we set that carries the message. This young man, John, told me one time, he said, "Jim, I'm so glad that your 12th step in Al-Anon says we carry this message to others." Doesn't say other affected family members. Doesn't say other alcoholics. Doesn't say other addicts. Just says to others. He says, "Because I'm so glad you've carried the message to me." Yeah. And I believe that message is one of love. The message is one of love, and it's love that I'm supposed to carry to others. The woman at the checkout counter when she's not checking things out quite as fast as I think she should. You know, the man who cuts in front of me in traffic and as I drive down the interstate. Need to love him, not throw the finger at him. Carry the message. Carry the message. There's another starlit night recently. It reminded me so much of that one in July. I had a men's conference 2 weeks ago. And the one that I had pretty much started. John and I really had kind of started it, this young man. And it was through our relationship that I began to kind of get interested in some of this stuff with men's work. And it was an AA and Al-Anon conference, but just for men. And John was not able to be at this meeting. And our relationship was kind of rocky at that point. And as I walked out of this time, about it was after midnight, and we'd had what we call storytelling, where we just sat around a fireplace and told stories about fathers and brothers and sons and other men in our lives. And it was a real spiritual moment. And I walked out by myself, and I looked up at the sky on top of the mountain. This time it was a cool night. But the sky looked like it did on that hot July night when I was out there with my father talking about that letter. And I was very, very grateful to John that night because, you see, today I don't trust that relationship's going to be okay, but I trust God. And I'm very grateful for what that relationship has been. And that conference occurred and some people's lives were touched because of our relationship. And that relationship and the love that I have for him made some good things happen. And a lot of people's lives have been touched because of it. And so when I can remember that it's not what I want to get in return, but when I can try to give freely and let go of the results, I know that my life is better. In closing, I'd like to close with a little prayer that means a lot to me. And it's something that I've used ever since I've been in the program. It's on, you and AA have the same thing. It's on this Just for Today little bookmark or pamphlet. And it's a prayer written by a man named Francis who lived in a little town, a little hilltop town in Assisi in Italy. And I'd like to close with it. Well, I want to come back. Let me come back to one other thing before I do that, because it occurred to me this morning just as I was in the chapel that what I started out with, that suffering, endurance, character, hope, that really has happened. It's that suffering, it's that pain that causes endurance. And endurance, as I see it, endurance somehow has to do with letting go of self-will. It has to do with waiting and patience. Endurance has to do with letting go of self-will and letting God's will be done. I'm willing to wait for God's will rather than have to have what I want today. From that endurance comes character. Character is what has been talking about that's been happening to me recently, kind of getting rid of that shame, knowing who I really am, being able to love myself, being able to really get in touch with who I am. That's character. That's character. And it's by getting rid of my will and letting God's will in that I have the courage to do that. And then from that character comes hope. And it's from that hope, knowing who I am and loving me just as I am, allows me to go out and work with others. And that's the hope of the world, is that each one of us can touch someone else in a very special way. The prayer now, the prayer of Francis of Assisi. You know, if you want to look up at the ceiling, if you want to just listen, if you'd like to bow your heads and pray, that's fine too. Whatever each one of you would like to do as I close with this. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. And where there is sadness, joy. O Divine Master, grant that I may not so much seek to be consoled as to console, to be understood as to understand, to be loved as to love. For it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned, and it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. At one point, I had some idea of eternal life as something that happened after death, and there might be pearly gates or golden streets. But today, through Al-Anon and the program of recovery that was so graciously given us by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe that I understand today that eternal life is something that I am right in the middle of, living one day at a time. Thank you.